Can we, as Christians and people of this world, I tell you, can the future of the Middle East actually truly be known?
Well, I believe it can. And, you know, it's interesting, when Muammar Gaddafi took the bullet to the head in October of 2011, Piers Morgan on CNN interviewed Dan Rather, the retired newscaster, and he asked him, you know, obviously there's going to be a regime change, he's saying to Dan Rather. He says, what can we expect with this new regime change? And Dan Rather's comment was, he who lives by the crystal ball walks on a lot of broken glass. And that was his humorous way of avoiding the question. But we know that the Lord knows the end from the beginning. And we're told in Isaiah 46, 9 and 10, it says, remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning. Ancient things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. So God is telling us in that those passages that there is none like him that can declare the end from the beginning. He holds Bible prophecy as his exclusive sovereign ability. And when I introduce my radio show, I have a radio show here in California called Prophecy Update. I say, welcome to another Prophecy Update radio program, whereby we intend to authenticate the sovereignty of God through Bible prophecy by telling you what Bible prophecy has to say about these last days. And the reason I say that is that we can, you know, God has chosen this as a means to authenticate his sovereignty. And so, yeah, we can. But we can know what he's opted to build to the prophets through the ages past, for us to know today. And because Israel is in the center of much of the Bible prophecies, and Israel is in the center of the geopolitical turbulence in the Middle East right now, we can expect that there was quite a bit written in the Bible about the Middle East, and indeed there is, and Revelation Road covers a bounty full of these prophecies. You know, one thing about this Arab Spring, you mentioned it, every one of the countries that were involved in the Arab Spring in North Africa and throughout the Middle East, for the most part, is involved in an end times Bible prophecy, whether it's Ezekiel 38 and 39 or Psalm 83 or Isaiah 17, the destruction of Damascus, and Syria is going ballistic right now. You know, the prophets have written about these countries, and since we are so deep into the end times, we have to think that what's around the corner is the fulfillment of some Bible prophecies. And these Bible prophecies that I'm alluding to feature populations that coalesce into confederacies that come against Israel. And so we're going to see change over there that, not like the liberal pundits are hoping for, that there'll be a bunch of, you know, Western-style democracies popping up over there. We're going to see a lot of Sharia law probably developing, especially starting in Egypt. We're probably going to see a lot of more rise of anti-Semitism and pro-Palestinianism. And we're probably going to see these Bible prophecies start to happen one upon another, happening soon and sequentially. That's what I would suggest. And
absolutely, because a lot of people might not know too much about how the Arab Spring worked and how it influenced the removal or installation of dictators. So I think you nailed it right on the head and how that plays into what we see today.
Well, it's, you know, the liberal pundits, like I was saying, would have you think that the Arab Spring was driven by the youth bulge in the Middle East through the social networks of Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And these youth looked outside of the confines of 7th century Islam and state-censored media and wanted to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And that's all a noble thought, but that's exactly not what is happening right now. Egypt is still in a state of turmoil, and 70% of its legislature has now been voted in are staunch Islamic, you know, Muslims calling for Sharia law, Muslim Brotherhood, Salafist al-Nur party, things like that. So, but what I believe is happening, Daniel 2:21, we're told that it's the Lord that changes times and seasons and removes kings and raises up kings. And we are seeing that take place right now. You know, we have had, it started with Tunisia. Ben Ali was deposed, and he had reigned over there for 23 years, and then immediately Mubarak, who had reigned over there in 30 years from Egypt, he stepped down, and then you had Gaddafi, who was assassinated in October. He had reigned for 42 years. You had also you had the Al Qaeda leaders. This is all last year. Bin Laden in May, Anwar al-Awlaki. You even had the leader of Syria step down, Saleh, who had reigned over there for I believe 20 to 30 years as well. I don't know how long. What does this mean? This means that kings are being removed, and thus kings are going to be raised up. So I would strongly suggest that not what the liberal pundits are thinking, but something is going on, and the Lord is removing kings and raising up kings. And personally, I think that's a big indicator for us to be watching. I like to use the word, I think it's out of the pool time in the Middle East. In other words, I think the storm is going to come over there, and the missiles are going to fly, and I think the 63 years of Israel existing as a nation and the countries trying to bring a remedy to the conflict over there between the Arabs and the Jews through land for peace deals and diplomacy, none of that has worked. And meanwhile, these countries are armed and dangerous, and they, for the most part, don't want Israel to exist in the region. So I'm concerned that these prophecies are about to happen, and that's the message I'm trying to signal with my books.
And Bill, one of the fascinating things about this line of research that you've opened up with the Psalm 83 is that you've brought to a lot of people's attention, probably for the first time, that the countries mentioned in that passage are actually the geopolitical forces there today. And so what you just said about the longtime dictators now being removed, doesn't that set up conditions perfectly for the prophecy to be fulfilled?
Well, it really does, you know, and something got to happen to start to make these prophecies come together. You know, I believe Psalm 83 is an imminent event. The only thing that really stands between it and not being imminent would be the fragile peace treaties between Egypt and Jordan that they possess with Israel, because Egypt and Jordan are in Psalm 83. So at some point they're going to forego those treaties and packed up with the Confederates of Psalm 83, and they're going to come against Israel. And we're told that they form a crafty plan. Come together with one consent so that they can destroy the nation, that the name of Israel will be remembered no more. And in Psalm 83, verse 12, we're given a clue as to what their underlying motive is. It says they want to take the pastures of God as a possession for themselves. So they want another Arab state over there, and they want to call it Palestine if this prophecy is about to find a near fulfillment, which I believe it is.
Now, Bill, a lot of people might get confused when they see everything happening in Iran, everything happening in Egypt, and everything happening how maybe Israel will respond to this. What is currently in chronological order on your radar screen in the Mideast right now?
Well, I think I'm going to try to do this speaking geopolitically, secularly, but with the prophetic twist in this thing, if that's okay. On my radar right now is a preemptive strike by Iran's nuclear sites. Now, whether or not Israel preempts that strike, and if someone strikes Iran at this point, it does seem pretty clear that it would have to be Israel. It's most likely not going to be America. So that could be the first thing. But on the other hand, Iran is also threatening to strike Israel because they don't want their nuclear development program to be sidelined or kicked back a few years. So there is a lot of talk now going on. And even in Iran, they're talking about them attacking Israel through their proxies. So to preserve their ability to maintain their nuclear program at the pace it's going, which is on fast track at this point, and there's concerns that their nuclear weapon will be developed this year. That's coming out of, you know, our Obama administration through Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, which suggests to me that if that's what he's saying, that it's probably closer than a year. But I'm looking for sparks to fly with Iran. This is what's going on over there right now. And if you've been following the headlines, it's no secret that Iran's, you know, threatening to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. They just cut off the flow of oil to seven European countries, the UK, France, Spain, the Netherlands. And this is in response to the European Union saying that they're going to stand behind these crippling sanctions that Obama wants, and that's going to take 6 months to implement. Well, you know, within a couple of weeks, Iran's already, you know, coming right back at them in their face saying, you know, well, we're going to cut off your oil. We're not worried about your crippling sanctions. So, you know, they want to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. They're threatening terrorism in America. They are attacking Israeli interests abroad. There's concerns they're going to start to attack American interests abroad and at home. These things are something that we could wake up tomorrow and see these things starting to happen. The Strait of Hormuz could be shut down tomorrow. The events that are going on by Iran right now are what's causing, in large part, the gas prices that we're paying at the pump in America over this past week to rise to the level it is. Here, over here in California, it's very common to see gas going out at $4.05, $4.10 a gallon. I know it's probably not that where you're at, but you know this is already happening. This is the highest it's ever been this time of the year ever in the country. When Obama became president back in 2009, the average gallon of gas was about $1.60. And I think, I don't know the average amount right now. I know about two or three months ago it was $3.40. It was up about $1.80 3 years that he took office. And it's up higher than that now. I would suggest it's probably up about $2 since he came into office, which doesn't bode very well for his foreign policy plans of engagement and things like that. But I'm watching for that. And I think from there, we could just have a whole ripple of effect with the proxies, with Syria, with Psalm 83, et cetera. So I won't just keep talking about those things, but if you want to egg me on further about what I think's after Iran and this scenario, then I've certainly got a lot to say about all that.
Well, that's funny you mention it, because that's exactly where I was going with the question. Given the fact that everything now is pointed at Iran, that, you know, obviously everyone is concerned about what the Iranians might do, and everyone is focused on that, including a lot of the people in their neighborhood, like Saudi Arabia, who are, I think, really terrified of a nuclear Iran. But given all that attention on Iran, what do you see are some triggers that turn all this around and put the spotlight on Israel as a villain? Because we know that there's something that prompts these nations to attack the Jewish state. How do you see some of this turning around on Israel?
Well, we just look into the details of the prophecies, because I think what we're seeing is the stage setting for these prophecies. I'll start with one that I don't think is imminent. I think it's near, but I don't think it's next, to give you an example. Ezekiel 38 and 39, 52 passages of very descriptive Bible prophecy of a coalition of nine that's spearheaded by Russia, Gog Magog invasion, that comes to invade in Israel in the last days, that's brought out of the nations that are dwelling securely in the midst of the land without walls, bars, or gates, and receipt of great plunder. This is what Russia forms this coalition to come after. So we know that at some point in time, Israel is going to be dwelling in that condition. I don't think they're dwelling in that condition just yet. They're not dwelling securely. They've got a 403-mile wall running down through Israel proper, trying to keep terror out. They are wealthy, but I don't believe they're in receipt of the kind of bounty that Russia would put together such an enormous coalition to come after. But we know they're going to come to destroy Israel for great plunder and booty, whereas the 10 populations in Psalm 83, which are Hezbollah in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestinians, the Hamas, the Saudis, and the Egyptians, they are going to assemble together to come against Israel, not for great plunder and booty, but, as I said in verse 12, to possess the pastures of God for themselves as a possession. So, you know, what's going to happen, I think, first, is Psalm 83 is going to occur. They are going to want to wipe Israel off the map, the Arabs, and have a state of Palestine. The two-state solution has fallen flat on its face. Diplomacy has failed, and when diplomacy fails, war begins. Something will come together where they will come against Israel. how I think this could very easily happen is that conflict between Iran and Israel, whether Israel strikes Iran or whether Iran falls upon its proxies, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas, which is a scenario I create in the storyline of Revelation Road, whether they Iran puts that together and they attack Israel, what one thing will lead to another, and the next thing you know, because Israel is now going to be dealing with an existential threat all around it, they will probably take out Damascus, and they have threatened to do so on several occasions. And if they take out Damascus, and they have the technologies to do that, you would highly likely have a fulfillment of Isaiah 17, which tells us in verse 1 that Damascus will cease to be a city, it will be a ruinous heap. Well, in verse 9, it appears as though Israel is responsible for that. And in verse 14, it says that eventide he exists, referring to Damascus, and in the morning he is no more. So it's as if Israel destroys the city night. And, you know, Israel does not have the ability, with the type of war we're talking about, the prophetic wars, to fight a war of attrition. And they realize this. And if something comes against them, then they have to act expeditiously and decisively. And Damascus is one of the closest major cities that Israel would have to lash out against. It's very strategic for them to do that. So, you know, they say that there's about 200,000 missiles pointed Israel right now, from the north through Hezbollah, which has about 50 to 60,000 rockets, Syria, who has the most advanced Scud missiles in the world, and they've given a lot of those Scud Ds to Hezbollah. Matter of fact, you know, all the stuff that's going on in Syria, up in Homs, which is the third largest city in Syria, it's about the size of San Diego or Dallas or San Antonio. Earlier this year, Bashar Assad sent a lot of his weapons up there to keep them safe from the protests that turned into a revolution, which is what they've got going right now. And Homs is the area really getting beaten up right now. Well, Homs is to the north and very close to the border of Lebanon, and turns that a lot of those weapons have been smuggled across the border into Hezbollah's hands. So it's all very dangerous, and they've got chemical weapons. There's tens of thousands of man pads in Syria's possession that nobody knows where they are right now. There's tanks that Syria's moving into Homs and those various areas. It's a real bloodbath over there right now inside of Syria. Interesting, I would say this regarding Syria, that when Bashar Assad saw Muammar Gaddafi laying dead in the street with a bullet in his head, and he started to get very concerned because rumblings were coming from Turkey that Turkey wanted NATO to get involved to put a no-fly zone together over Syria like they had done with Libya. And, of course, the end result in Libya was the death of Muammar Gaddafi and the toppling of that regime. So Bashar Assad said, and this was toward the end of last year, that if that happened, it wasn't that he was going to fight against NATO or the West. His first response was, if that happens within 6 hours, we will send missiles into Tel Aviv. It wasn't as if Israel had said anything or prompted anything, but this is what was going to be the target, Tel Aviv. And then he said, we will have Hezbollah send rockets as well, and he said, we will have Iran protect the Persian Gulf against ships from the West coming in. So what do we have here? We have this proxy scenario. These countries and terrorist populations, Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas, have bona fide war pacts that they put together in December of 2009. So, you know, they're in a position right now where anything that could happen to any one of these could draw all of them into a war. And I believe that if you see Damascus go up in smoke and you have thousands, tens of thousands of Syrian refugees flooding the northern deserts of Iraq and Jordan, you are going to have a major problem and probably catalyze the Psalm 83 war. So these are the kinds of things that are happening. And if you noticed lately, the news, which was really just dominating, you know, dominating all of its coverage toward election year and the Republican candidates and all these sort of things, they're having to share a lot of the time with what's going on in Israel and concerns about Iran right now. And I believe that the Lord is putting the spotlight on the Middle East. I believe that these things are about to happen, and we could wake up, missiles could be flying. And if those missiles end up hitting their targets, and if they have prophetic implications, and if these wars begin, then I think Americans will be paying a lot more than $4 a gallon at the tank, and that could happen anytime soon.
Well, we've already seen record numbers at the tank, like you mentioned. It's the world history record in the United States for February gas prices. And when you talked about how they blame Israel for everything that happens, that's just like in this country, liberals who blame George Bush for everything that's ever happened wrong in their lives. The rest of the world blames Israel for everything that happens. And Ahmadinejad says that even if he even thinks that Iran is Israel's an imminent threat to Iran, then he will strike first. Yet, even in the mainstream media, people are waiting and assuming that Israel is going to strike that nuclear facility at any moment now. So it seems like not only is the misguided leadership in Iran taking people down a road of fear, they're not listening to what's going on in the rest of the world about how Israel could really make that attack. And now if Israel does attack those nuclear facilities and Iran responds back, is this Psalms 83, or are we talking about Gog Magog here?
Well, I don't think it's Gog of Magog yet, because I don't think the Israel I described earlier, dwelling securely in the midst of the land in receipt of great plunder and booty, exists just yet. They are not dwelling securely. They are existential threat from Iran and from the surrounding nations that are involved in Psalm 83. So I believe it would be Psalm 83 first. It's interesting that in the Gog of Magog battle, the nine coalition members of the Confederacy in Gog and Magog, they represent what I've coined in Israelistan an outer ring of nations. They are not the inner circle, which I called Psalm 83, the countries that share common borders with Israel. Ezekiel did not list Edomites and Ammonites and Moabites and the groups that Asaph, the prophet, the psalmist, wrote in Psalm 83. They were not listed by Ezekiel. In chapter 38, he happened to list them 89 times elsewhere throughout all of his prophetic chapters, but he opted not to list them in Ezekiel 38, which causes me to wonder why not, because he was very descriptive about the nine populations, Meshech and Tubal and Persia and Gomer and Togarma and all those populations he listed, but he opted not to list any of the inner circle. So I suspect he didn't list them because they're not involved, and they're probably not involved because they're part of Psalm 83. So I suggest that once Israel, and I believe the Israeli Defense Forces, will be called to the occasion to defeat the Psalm 83 countries, and I believe the Israeli Defense Forces exist today in fulfillment of Bible prophecies in Ezekiel 25:14 and Obadiah 1:18 and Ezekiel 37:10 and elsewhere. Once they defeat the Arabs, and they will have to because it's an existential threat, and the Lord will not allow the Jews to be destroyed because that would then make the apple of his eye go away, Zechariah 2:8, and that thus he would be a promise breaker because he promised Abraham that he would have descendants forever. So I believe that once Israel wins that war, they will dwell securely, probably capitalize on Arab spoils of war, annex more territory, which they have a pattern of doing. Joshua did it 3,500 years ago. David did it 3,000 years ago. And modern-day State of Israel did it in 1967. And then they become the Israel that I believe entices Russia to form its coalition, which is predominantly a Muslim coalition of Iran and Turkey and Libya and other countries that come against Israel. Imagine this scenario. Psalm 83 happens, and those Muslim countries involved in the Gog and Magog scenario are absolutely upset with Israel. Those are Muslim countries in Psalm 83, and Israel defeats them in this scenario, and that will upset those other Muslim countries. And then all of a sudden Israel starts taking some of that land, which they will feel justified to do because we're told in Genesis 15:18 that the Lord gave Abraham land that extended from the river of Egypt, which would be the Nile, on through the river Euphrates, which courses through modern-day Iraq and Syria. So you've got Israel starting to take a bit of a land grab, and I believe they'll take Jordan, according to Jeremiah 49, verses 1 and 2. I believe at some point they'll take the eastern upper section of Egypt, because Isaiah 19 18 says, five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan, which is Hebrew. One of those cities, it says, will be called the city of destruction. So they start grabbing some land. I don't believe they're going to take all the land. I believe that they get all the land when Messiah returns in the second coming. But I believe they take some more land between now and then and after Psalm 83. That is going to infuriate Iran and Turkey and Libya and those other Muslim countries. Now, throw the rapture in. Okay? You've got Israel has just defeated a massive confederacy of Arabs that come against them. The world is in shock. And all of a sudden, church gets taken out of here. Well, what's going to happen is Western armies like America and the UK are going to be affected by that, affected adversely by that. But there won't be anybody taken out of the Muslim armies of the Gog and Magog scenario. They will be strong, and they will probably rise to the occasion and say, look, what's stopping us now? We can take out Israel, our formidable coalition, and we can take over all that great plunder that Israel is now coming into possession with. And don't forget that Russia is the number one supplier of oil in the world now, and Iran is the number two supplier in OPEC. They could come along and pretty much rule the world by taking over all the energy sources. And if you look at the Gog and Magog scenario, the populations that are involved in Ezekiel 38, the ones that Russia brings into their coalition, they are all bordering on the important waterways that Israel would need to export this great plunder and booty that they're in possession of. And we know they're going to want to be wanting to do that because you have these merchants of Tarshish, along with Sheba and Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish and their young lions, that are saying to the coalition, what are you doing? Are you coming to get great plunder and great booty? Well, the theme of merchants of Tarshish suggests that there's somebody wanting to conduct commerce with Israel. And all of a sudden, Russia puts this coalition together, and they've got Iran blocking the Persian Gulf, they've got Turkey blocking the northern Mediterranean, they've got Libya blocking the southern Mediterranean, they've got the descendants of Kush down through Ethiopia and the Sudan blocking the Red Sea. How is Israel going to get their bounty to market? I think it's part of Gog's evil plan. Form a coalition of Muslim countries that are infuriated by Israel. They did in Psalm 83, strategically located countries that can block Israel's ability, choke off their ability to have any commerce, and then invade and take it. And it's a foolproof plan as far as they're concerned, especially if the rapture has happened and the West can only stand on the sidelines going, what are you doing? But what they don't factor into the equation is what happens in Ezekiel 38 verses 16 through Ezekiel 39 verses 6, which is a divine hand of God with a major earthquake, that the mountains begin to topple, and then you have friendly fire going on. They're killing one another, and you have fire and brimstone hailing down from heaven, and it's clearly the Lord, not the Israeli Defense Forces, stop that invasion. Well, in Ezekiel 39:7, the reason. It says, I will uphold my holy name in the midst of my people Israel, not the church, in the midst of my people Israel, and the nation shall know that I am the Lord. The Lord chooses that occasion, where Israel has to be in the land, brought out of the nations, and there has to be an Israel. There has to be a Jewish people, my people Israel. The Lord can uphold his holy name and say, look, I am the promise-keeping God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I have just delivered the Jewish people from the most massive, armed, and dangerous Mideast invasion in all of history. And people, you need to recognize that I am the Lord, because shortly thereafter, in my estimation, because I believe that's a pre-trib event, they will have to make a choice between the Lord, who just upheld his holy name through the midst of his people Israel, and the Antichrist, and his cashless society that will be coming in the tribulation. I think we're getting pretty close, gang, and this is what I'm watching for and trying to signal out there.
Well, now, Bill, I said early on that I agree with you about Psalm 83, and I do. I definitely do. But I know there are other people out there who have maybe a different interpretation. I think probably I'm talking about people of more liberal persuasion. So if I'm playing devil's advocate for just a minute, what do you answer to people who say that, for example, these prophecies found their fulfillment in either the Six-Day War or the Yom Kippur War or something like that?
Well, since Israel Stein came out in the summer of 2008, Jim, I've been pretty much hit with every potential objection there is to my hypothesis that Psalm 83 is an imminent event that we should be looking for. I'll start with one of the main objections that comes out is that a lot of people think it's nothing more than an imprecatory prayer, that some of them say the Psalms are not prophecies, even though Asaph, we're told in 2 Chronicles 29, is a chozah, the Hebrew word seer, meaning a beholder of vision, a prophet. And Psalm 83 is the most prophetic of anything he's written in all the Psalms. So some of them believe it's really nothing more than just an imprecatory prayer, a prayer of lament, maybe a Psalm 2 scenario of, and this would be Dr. Mark Hitchcock's view. It's not a specific prophecy. He's come out in his new book called Middle East Burning, saying that one of the reasons he's discounting it as anything but a prayer per se is because he doesn't believe that other prophets have written about it. And I would say I could probably list 20 prophecies of other prophets and of all the Edomites and the Ammonites and the Moabites and the other participants of Psalm 83 that I think Mark would have an extremely difficult time explaining that they were also historically fulfilled. So I would disagree with him there, and I don't believe it's just another Psalm 2 because Psalm 2 doesn't identify specific populations. And I could go on and on with the list. And Mark's my friend, so I'm not trying to single him out. But that's one of the objections. Now, the other one is in 2 Chronicles 20. Some of them believe it was historically fulfilled in 2 Chronicles 20, but there was only three populations of the 10 involved then. So you kind of look through and go, because a Bible prophecy, when it's fulfilled, has to be fulfilled exactly as it's specified, and all the populations have to be involved. Well, if three of them are involved and seven of them aren't, well, then you can't consider that a final fulfillment of that prophecy. So 2 Chronicles 20 in the Old Testament, no, that was not a fulfillment. Then the other one is that, well, it could have been 1948 and 1967. Again, not all the 10 populations were involved. If you could say, well, they kind of were in 1948. 1948 would have been a better argument than 1967. But really what you had there was a stage setting. The attitude was on display of Psalm 83, the adversarial attitude against Israel, certainly on display in all those wars. And 1948 probably came the closest to it. But one of the things we recognize is the way Asaph petitions the Lord in verses 9, 10, and 11 of Psalm 83. He's asking the Lord to judge these countries in the historical precedent of what happened during the time of Gideon when the Midianites, and you go back to Judges chapters 4 through 8 to see where Asaph is taking us with this request. But you had the Midianites who had oppressed the Jews, the Israelites, for 7 years, and then all of a sudden Gideon comes along with his 300-band army, and they go out, and they're empowered by the Lord and kill 105,000 Midianites. And in the end, the Midianites cease to ever oppress Israel again. You will never find in the Bible or historically hearing about the Midianites oppressing Israel again. Then he goes on and talks about at the time of the prophetess Deborah and her general Barak. At the time, the Canaanites had oppressed the Jews for 20 years, King Jabin, and his general was Sisera. So he's asking the Lord to deal with it that way, and Barak defeated them. And the Canaanites ceased to ever oppress Israel again. Well, are the Arabs oppressing Israel presently? 1948 Arabs? Well, certainly they are. 1967 and 1973, intifadas. Hezbollah's war in 2006 when 4,000 rockets were lobbed to the north, and they've got 50,000 plus rockets now. They are still prepared to oppress Israel again. I believe that when the IDF defeats these Arab countries in Psalm 83, they will cease to ever oppress Israel again. And I think that's key. Now, the other objection is in Ezekiel. A lot of people throw Psalm 83 into Ezekiel 38, and I think they kind of have to because they'll acknowledge, I don't agree with them, but I think that they really don't have much choice if they can't put it anywhere else, and if they disagree with my hypothesis, they have to kind of throw it into Ezekiel 38. I think Philip Goodman does, and some other people do this. And what they do is they'll say Ezekiel 39:6 says that, you know, all these hordes of Gog, and he lists who they are with Meshach and Tubal, and says, and there's many peoples with thee, which probably just alludes to the fact that these armies are massive. There's many people with Gog and Magog. But they say, because those represent far countries, an outer ring, that something has to be done with those countries that are hostile to Israel that fought them in 1948, 1967, 1973, because they are Israel's most observable enemies today, and since Israel became a nation in 1948, and quite frankly, since time immemorial. So something has to be done with them. Why would they not enlist with Russia? Coalition. So they sort of lump them in there. And again, as I explained, why didn't Ezekiel include their names? He wrote about the Edomites and Edom and Ammonites and Ammon and Philistia and Philistines and all the groups. He mentioned even Gabal, which is in Psalm 83. Who's ever heard of Gabal? That's up in northern Lebanon. Well, the Psalm 83's got Gabal in there, and Ezekiel mentioned it in his books, but he didn't include any of those guys amongst the nine members of Ezekiel 38. I really tried to look at these arguments. I could tell you why it's not in the tribulation too, which is what Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum initially thought it was until he and I had the opportunity to kind of talk about that on the radio show. And if you have a moment, I'll tell you why it's not there also. But I've looked at all these arguments, Jim. I certainly don't want to stand before the Lord and say, what, you know, great job there, son, but you really messed up on that Psalm 83 thing. I don't want that to happen. So I really tried to be objective about these things, but none of these things fit for me, Jim. I mean, it's just, to me, it's an imminent event, and we should be watching for it, and that's the alarm I'm sounding.
We're on live tonight with Bill Salas from Prophecy Depot Ministries, and let's go to the phones right now from the state of Georgia to area code 229. You're on live with Bill, Jim, and myself. How are you this evening?
Hey, good evening. How y'all doing tonight?
Doing good. Did you have a question for us?
Yeah, I was just listening to Bill here talking to in regards to the Psalm 83 war. Don't you think that the that tempest is going to take care of them regional enemies of Israel in verse 15?
I do. I think that is that's the other part of the psalm that I think is pretty telling. When you get past what I just talked about the historical precedent Asaph appeals to the Lord for in Judges 4 through 8, you have these other passages taking you on through the rest of the psalm that talks about a, you know, whirlwind and turning them into stubble and the tempest and all this sort of thing, which are clear pictures of a defeat of these countries. And, you know, it does. It takes care of them so that, in my estimation, that they would never oppress Israel again. And I believe there's such great description given, especially like in Obadiah, verses 1, 18, 19, and 20, chapter 1, verses 18, 19, and 20, that literally even talks about where the prisoners of war are going to go. I think that the caller is right. I think that that is just another evidence that once the IDF defeats these countries, if that's what he was alluding to, the tempest, he could be maybe suggesting it's a natural cataclysmic thing. But I would say that he's right, once they're just defeated, they never oppress Israel again. Now, I like to say this when I start talking about this, is that the Lord does not delight in the destruction of the Arabs. He does not delight in the destruction of the wicked. He loves everyone. He sent Jesus to die for everyone's sins, that none would perish, but all would have everlasting life who would believe in him. But, you know, God has foreign policy in place in Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3, which calls for those people that bless Israel will be blessed, and those people that curse Israel will be cursed. And that policy is still effectually intact. So I think it's really important to warn the Arabs that they should not curse Israel, and they should not be involved in anything to do with these prophecies, because the judgment of God is going to be leveled upon them. It says in Ezekiel 25:14, I will execute my vengeance on Edom by the hand of my people Israel, and they shall know my fury and my vengeance. By the hand of my people Israel, by the IDF. Edom is the lead player, the tents of Edom in Psalm 83. Yeah. So by association, this gives us an evidence of when, you know, how this is going to come down. They're going to try to destroy Israel militarily in a confederacy.
Yeah.
And militarily, they will be defeated, curse for curse in kind. I actually connect that prophecy, that portion of Isaiah 11, with Psalm 83. That this is why I think it's important to understand where Psalm 83 fits, not in the tribulation. And let me tell you why. And this is the discussion I had with Arnold Fruchtenbaum, who put in his book The Footsteps of Messiah. Arnold was one of the few guys who actually started teaching on Psalm 83 before it really started catching wind with anybody. And he called it a legitimate prophecy, and he pretty much called it a 10-member confederacy that comes to invade Israel. He just happened to put it into the tribulation. And so I sat with Arnold, and I have this on the radio program, Prophecy Update, and I said, Arnold, isn't it true that in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, the Jews will be living in a sense of peace and security because of the false covenant? And he said, absolutely. He said, they will be feeling so secure that the IDF will not even be able to stop the Antichrist from going into the temple to abominate it at the midpoint of the tribulation. I said, okay, great. So we don't expect the IDF to be fighting off the Arabs of Psalm 83 in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. Is that correct, Arnold? And he said, no, you're right. Okay, then I said, then let's take the second half. The Antichrist, according to Zechariah 13:8, starts to commit a genocide campaign of the Jews, and we see that 2/3 of the Jews will be cut off in the land. It's a picture of the Jews fleeing and not fighting. We're told, and Christ even instructs them in Matthew 24, that when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet, he doesn't say, get your guns out. He says, flee to the mountains. He says, flee to the wilderness. So it's a picture of flight and seeking refuge. Pray that your flight not be in the winter when the wadis can drown you. Pray that it not be on the Sabbath when all the transportation is shut down. Pray that you not be pregnant with babe, because who wants to flee, you know, when you're 9 months pregnant? You just can't. You're going to be in peril. So, all due respects, I don't follow that line of thinking that Psalm 83 is involved in the tribulation period. But, you know, again, the verdict isn't out on all this stuff, but the good thing is people are talking about it and studying. What is the gap between Psalm 83, if it precedes Ezekiel 38, how much time spans between that? Well, I'm going to give you my old view on that, and then my new one since I've written Revelation Rogue. My old view was it's going to take a little bit of time, and I would say at least several years, because the Israel described in Ezekiel 38, verses 8 through 13, dwelling securely, wealthy, without walls, probably takes a little bit of time to get there. You know, they've got to mop up after the Psalm 83 war. They've got to deal with the prisoners of war. You know, cleaning up a war is not an easy deal. And then becoming secure and wealthy. You know, it depends. It's relevant to how they accumulate that wealth, how quickly they get it. It's relevant to if they discover oil or, you know, find wealth within their own resources and means, in addition probably to the Arab spoils of war. So I was thinking it was going to take a little bit of time. But I think the real wild card in all this is the rapture. Rapture could occur before, during, or after Psalm 83. It could occur before, during, or after Ezekiel 38. So we don't know exactly when that's going to happen. But I have, and many of my colleagues have strong reasons to believe that the rapture occurs before Ezekiel 38. And we certainly don't want a date set or anything like that. But the Ezekiel 38 scenario is all about God upholding his holy name in the midst of his people Israel. Three times in Ezekiel 38 and 39, he calls them my people Israel, beckons the question, where's the church and things like that. So, I mean, there's many arguments. They burn weapons for 7 years. You know, will they be able to burn weapons when they're fleeing for their lives in the second half of the trib? Meaning they probably, Ezekiel 38 has to conclude, not commence, 3.5 years before the 7-year tribulation. I mean, there's all these arguments that suggest Ezekiel 38 is a pre-trib event, and probably that the rapture could even precede Ezekiel 38. But now I'm thinking, after Psalm 83, if the rapture happens, the Russians will, with their Islamic cohorts, seize the opportunity to move in on Israel. And that could happen very quickly, because we know how quick coalitions can be formed. We saw it with George H. Bush and the meager attempt with George W. Bush and things like that. So I'm thinking that it's going to be a lot sooner than I originally thought. But I think the wild card is the rapture. Are some logistics that have to happen after Psalm 83? But if the rapture happens, all bets are off, and that Russian Confederacy is going to seize the opportunity, in my estimation, to just come. And really, I think their goal is ultimately to control all the energy resources. Remember that Russia and OPEC and Israel, if they come into possession of this wealth, they supply a lot of the natural gas and oil to Europe and to China and all these places. So if they can control that pocket of all the wealth and power and resources, they can control the world. And I think that's their ultimate goal, get Israel out of the way and be the world's greatest superpower. And, of course, they're in for a strong wake-up call. But I hope that answers the question.
Well, if we're talking about the Gog-Magog scenario, do you see this as a clearly that Russia would take the lead in this coalition, or do you see it as more of an equitable leadership force with maybe Iran and Turkey and countries like that?
Well, I think Ezekiel 38 points to Gog, you know, the chief prince, meaning probably a title of the ruler. Maybe it's a Putin, or, you know, if it happened in the near future, it could very well be Putin, who's sort of spearheading this confederacy. And then we're told it's got, you know, Persia and Togarma, and then with them that come with helmet and sword. So they seem to be hordes that come along with Gog. But I really see Gog comes down from the north, which gives us an indication that's Russia. And you find that you follow the history of Magog and, you know, the connection with the Scythians and that sort of thing. I really do believe it's Russia at the helm. I'm not so sure these days. I used to think it was primarily a very nuclear-equipped invasion, and we certainly know Russia's got tons of nuclear weapons, and it will probably be a very nuclear-equipped invasion. But I used to say it's a Russian-Iranian-led nuclear-equipped invasion. But I'm... the more I study Jeremiah 49, dealing with the prophecies of Elam, I'm not so sure that Iran, which is ranked number 12 among world armies today, Russia's ranked number 2, I'm not so sure that Iran is in full force with the coalition. I think something might happen to Iran in advance, and I think Jeremiah may have maybe possibly even predicted what we might see happen in the news any day now, where there's a strike upon Iran's nuclear programs, because Jeremiah 49, verses 34 through 39, talk about, Jeremiah issues 9 prophecies dealing with Elamites. And the Elamites, Jeremiah and Ezekiel wrote at the same time, about 2,500 years ago. They were contemporaries of each other. And the prophecies dealing with Iran, most people talk about Persia involved in Ezekiel 38 and 39, the Gog and Magog invasion. Seldom do you hear anybody talking about the prophecies of Elam. And Elam and Persia comprise what is today modern-day Iran. At the time that these prophets wrote, Persia did not comprise all of modern-day Iran. It comprised most of it. But there was a west-central area along the coast of the Persian Gulf that was called Elam, and its capital city was Susa. So Jeremiah is writing prophecies about Elam, and Ezekiel is writing prophecies about Persia. And so I'm wondering, well, why are they doing that? You know, are they in the same prophecy? Why didn't Ezekiel include Elam? He mentions Elam several other places in his chapters, but he doesn't include them alongside Persia and Meshech and Tubal. Matter of fact, in Ezekiel 32, he mentions Elam next to Meshech and Tubal, but when he talks about Meshech and Tubal, in Ezekiel 38, he throws in Persia and not Elam. So he clearly knew geographical distinctions and cultural differences that existed between the Elamites and the Persians back during their time. But he opts to write about Persia in Ezekiel 38 and excludes Elam. Whereas Jeremiah tells us Elam's involved in a very powerful end times prophecy, it appears. And what it says, and if you search high and low through history, you'll find that this prophecy has probably not found fulfillment. That it says that Elam is going to be, his bow is going to be broken. The launching, the bow would be a launching device, and the Elamites were known to be expert archers. So it's a very important thing to recognize that this would make a lot of sense when Jeremiah made this prophecy. Specific to the Elamites, it says their bow will be broken, and they will be struck at the foremost of their might. Which, if this prophecy has not found fulfillment yet, and is about to find fulfillment, what would be the foremost of Iran's might today? Well, it would undoubtedly be its nuclear program. They are very close to having nuclear weapons. So then it says that the four winds from heaven will start to come, and the Elamites, the outcasts of Elam, it says, will be scattered, and it says there'll be no nation where the outcasts of Elam don't go. In other words, there's going to be a dispersion after Elam gets struck at the foremost of its might. Now, it happens to be that one of Iran's primary nuclear sites today is the Bushehr nuclear plant, and the Bushehr nuclear plant is located in the heart of ancient Elam. The Bushehr nuclear plant in the summer of 2010 was loaded with Russian fuel rods. And I can remember former UN Ambassador John Bolton saying at the time that when those rods get in place, Israel's ability to safely strike that facility will be closed. That window will be closed because now if they hit it, it could create nuclear radioactive fallout. And it could be really bad, way worse than Chernobyl. So is Jeremiah telling us that the foremost of Iran's might, their nuclear program, may get struck, not all of its nuclear program, because Elam didn't cover all of modern-day Iran, it only covered a very specific geographical area, and could it create a nuclear disaster? And is this why the Elamites are dispersed? Now, unless this prophecy has found historical fulfillment, this could become a very real scenario in what's in play in the geopolitical events of what's going on in the news today. So, you know, see, I think sometimes we need to be careful about getting sensational paper exegesis, but at the same token, not at the cost of ignoring something that could be very descriptive for our generation to try to understand. So this prophecy, much like Psalm 83 was a few years ago, is one of those prophecies that is being explored. I know that John McTernan's starting to write about it, and Sean Osborne, and I even know Joel Rosenberg has started to mention it a little bit in some of his teaching. And Joel Rosenberg is very well schooled on Iran and the end times prophecy, especially Ezekiel 38 and 39. So we start to study these things. I just posted this very detailed article on my website, prophecydepot.com, called The Dual Prophecies of Iran. And it's taken out of Revelation Road, where you can get so much more on this subject in the book, Revelation Road. But if the listeners are fascinated by this possibility, because these are the days where your television's on and your Bible's open, and you're watching to see if events going on in the world and in the Middle East, and I think we might have something very telling here to be watching for that Jeremiah may have wrote. Ezekiel wrote this prophecy, this dry bones vision. There was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom because Solomon, his son Rehoboam, and he had Jeroboam, who was a foreman of his laborers. They split the kingdom, and Jeroboam took Benjamin and Judah, the southern kingdom, and then the northern kingdom was the other 10 tribes. And so, although Assyria conquered the northern kingdom in 722 BC, still was a divided kingdom, and Judah was conquered in 586 around the by Babylon, and of course that's when Ezekiel and Jeremiah were writing around that time. So they were very familiar with the divided kingdom. Now what he's saying after verse 12 and 13, when the Lord is talking about bringing the Jews back into the land out of the nations of the world, verse 12 says, prophesy to them, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up from your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. That's how we know they were outside in the diaspora. So they come into the land after the Holocaust. And then he goes on later in verse 20 and talks about these two sticks, which, if I recall, and I haven't looked at this in a while, is a picture of these two sticks coming together. It says, one king shall rule over them. It becomes an Israel that is no longer a divided kingdom. It's a united kingdom. And that's the Israel we have today. When you look at Israel today, you don't look at two separate kingdoms, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, which for centuries they did. So I think it's a picture of they come out of the Holocaust into the land of Israel as one united nation, is how I understand those passages. And, of course, it goes on even to talk about the resurrected David and the Messianic kingdom in verses 24 throughout the rest of the heaven. So I think they come out of the nations of the world as a united kingdom.
Okay, now we'll take a caller here from Colorado. Go ahead, you're on live with Bill.
Yeah, Bill, this is Neil from Colorado, and I just want to ask your take on that Psalms 83:3 on those hidden ones, and I'll take it offline.
Yes. Talking about the sheltered ones, okay. It's interesting because some people, like Chuck Missler, for instance, in fact, let me read it because maybe the listeners aren't familiar with it. It's a very interesting passage. It says in verse 3, dealing with plan that these Confederates are going to put together, these Arab Confederacy, and it says, they have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered, hidden ones. So Chuck Missler would interpret that, and I've talked to Chuck about this when we shared platforms together. He believes that your people, of course, would represent Israel, but we may have a reference in his estimation when you talk about the sheltered ones as being the church. And so I told Chuck that I didn't agree with that, and that's always hard to do because Chuck Missler's quite the scholar. And but I said, you know, the Hebrew word there is Safa, and it first shows up when Moses' mother is putting him in the little, you know, floating cradle and putting him in the Nile River. And so Moses represents, in that scenario, in my estimation, probably a type of the remnant comes to belief, and, of course, he gets picked up, and we know the whole story about Moses. The second time the word shows up is when Ahab is hiding the two spies. So again, we have this picture of the, you know, these faithful Jews, probably more of a representation to me of not the church, but you know, the remnant of Jews within the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel presently is not saved per se. They don't believe in Messiah and stuff like that, but there will be a remnant that comes out of them, a faithful remnant that will recognize that Jesus is the Lord, and they will fulfill the mandate of Matthew 23 that says, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. They will do that in their affliction, we're told in Hosea 5:15, and the Lord will return when they do that. They will, as a nation, recognize Jesus as the Messiah. Now, to put the church there, you have to put all of the prophecy in Psalm 83. So it says they form crafty counsel against your people, the Jews, and they consult together against the church. So all of a sudden now you got to say Arabs are going to consult together against the Jews and the Christians, the church. Okay, so it starts to make it sound a little bit cattywampus so far. And then it starts coming down and says, let us cut them off from being a nation. Well, the church isn't really a nation. Now, Israel is presently, that the name Israel may be remembered no more. So, again, it's still very Jewish. It's not, you're not cutting the church off, that the name the church will be remembered no more. And they go to the Confederacy against you. And, of course, they're all the enemies of Israel, the Edomites and Ishmaelites, etc. So they're Missler would disagree with me, and others maybe. I just don't personally see the church there. I think that's more of a picture of the nation of Israel as your people, and the sheltered or the hidden ones, Safa, as probably the remnant that exists within the people today. And they probably don't even know who they are, of course, at this point, because they come into belief after the rapture. Because if they came into belief before the rapture, they would be raptured. So that's my take on that.
Bill, one of the other really controversial issues right now within the Bible prophecy community is this idea that Islam becomes so dominant that that the Antichrist himself is a Muslim. What is your take on that?
Well, that is certainly getting momentum. It's being forwarded by Waleed Shubat and Paul Richardson. I don't think so because, well, let's start with a few things. Let's look at the geopolitical situation by the time the Antichrist arrives on the scene. If Psalm 83 is a bona fide prophecy and happens soon, and if it's followed by Ezekiel 38, and if those are both pre-trib events, well, let's look at that. You have 10 total Muslim populations, the nations that surround Israel today, involved in Psalm 83. They get defeated by the Israeli Defense Forces. I would consider that a strong punch to the gut of Islam if that happened. Already many Arabs are wondering how come Israel even still can defend itself after the wars that have gone on, you know, because they look to Allah to be superior over there. So they're questioning that in some level. Not, of course, that's a minority. But so that Psalm 83 happens. It's a punch to the gut of Islam. Ezekiel 38 follows. Ezekiel 38 is, there's nine populations involved, of which all of them except Russia are predominantly Muslim. Turkey's 99% Muslim. And they get defeated by the Lord. That, to me, is an uppercut to the jaw. So they've been punched in the gut during Psalm 83. They got an uppercut to the jaw now in Ezekiel 38. And so by the time the tribulation begins, Islam is a waning religion. It's a compromised religion compared to what it presently is. I write about this in Revelation Road, and I do some demographics on Islam across the world. There's 1.3 billion or so Muslims in the world right now. And 20% of those approximately are involved in Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38. So about 20% of the Muslim population, and actually the more fundamental aspects of Islam, are going to be toppled in Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38. Then you have other arguments that that come up. Daniel 9:26 tells us that the Antichrist will come out of the people that destroyed the city and the sanctuary. That would be the Roman Empire. He will come out of the Roman Empire. that they destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. In Revelation 13, we see that he will be a Gentile. He comes out of the, it says the beast rises out of the sea, which would tend to represent the Gentiles. Mark Hitchcock does some pretty good arguments on this. It's a Gentile that rules over the Gentile empires, and then I think it was in Daniel 11 he points out that this Antichrist, or it could be 2 Thessalonians, I apologize, he's going to go into the temple, and he's going to abominate it, and he's going to declare himself to be above, exalt himself above all things that are called God. And any Muslim that would do that, and that would be an anathema, a fatwa would be out on them immediately. He would be killed. They would argue, well, another one would rise up. Well, then he would be killed too. And then another one, and he would be killed too. So I just don't see it. And those are my reasons.
All right, Bill, we have a question concerning the United States from the email. This is a direct quote from the listener that says, I believe that the rapture may occur prior to Psalms 83, Isaiah 17, and Ezekiel 38:39, because the U.S. will be in no position to react in the Middle East after the rapture. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say, first of all, we don't know, but I would say that there is some merit to that argument. Matter of fact, I put together the different trains of thought on the pre-Psalm 83 rapture and the pre-Ezekiel 38 rapture, and I covered quite extensively in Revelation Road, my new book. But the one thing that there might be some merit in this question is that Ezekiel 38 is a very interesting scenario because you have these protesters on the sidelines that seem to be protesting. They're abstaining from the battle, and they're protesting, and amongst them is the merchants of Tarshish and their young lions. So some people think that the merchants of Tarshish, young lions, be representative of Spain, because, you know, we hear in Jonah chapter 1, we see that Jonah takes off in the wrong direction. He doesn't head toward Nineveh, and we find out a connection with Tarshish down toward the Spain area and things like that. And then the colonies developed with South America and Central America, you know, with the young lions, etc. That's one train of thought. I happen to go with the train of thought that David Hawking and others have. And David Hawking, my estimation, has done one of the best studies on this I've ever heard, where he connects the young lions to a vast amount of research with the UK. In other words, the merchants of Tarshish probably being the UK and the colonies that sprouted forth once upon a time when the sun never set on the British Empire, of course, went down through Australia and through Canada and North America and stuff like that. So I think personally, if America's in Bible prophecy, and that we would probably be there in the merchants of Tarshish and their young lions. And But why are we simply protesting? This does not appear to be a picture of people in a Cold War scenario with Russia like we used to have. It does not appear to be the superpower America. Why not? Well, you know, Mark Hitchcock's wrote in The Late Great United States. Terry James has wrote in The American Apocalypse. David Reagan has wrote in American the Beautiful. They've been burdened with this question about American Bible prophecy. I've had the opportunity to interview all three of these guys on Prophecy Update. And the good news is they all pretty much have consensus that if Israel's in Bible prophecy, it's not the same superpower status that it presently is. So what happens? Could it be war? Could it be the rapture? Could it be internal, an EMP attack? Could it be terrorism? You know, so they list all these different things, and it could be any one of those or a combination of those. Rapture certainly would come into play. So it could be that America is on the sidelines after the rapture, unable to really mount much of an offensive against Russia and its coalition, and therefore reduced to protesters on the sidelines. But I would say the good news here, if we're not raptured at that point in time, and if we are the young lions, someone and their young lions is wanting to conduct commerce with Israel's great resources, because that's what Russia's coming to take away. And if that happens to be the UK and America, that might bode well, because remember it says in Genesis 12, 2 and 3, that those that bless Israel will be blessed. Now, after Psalm 83, the world economies are going to really be hit by that. You know, we're already seeing gas prices go up through the roof right now. The global economies are faltering. They just had to give Greece, you know, $1.7 billion. You know, all we need is a Middle East war of epic biblical proportion to send global economies into a tailspin. So we're going to need to work with Israel if they're wealthy, dwelling securely, with a lot of resources and control maybe over some of the oil and stuff. You know, would behoove us to be on the sidelines as merchants joined with as the young lions and saying, hey, let's conduct some commerce. Let's get our economies going again. We'll scratch your back. You scratch our economic back. So I kind of hope we are there as far as the country. I hope we're raptured before. But if America is over there trying to conduct commerce with Israel, that's probably a good thing.
Bill, to continue on just for a second here about the United States, for the first time since Israel's existence, this current administration has really taken a step back from their friendship with Israel. Barack Obama has been heard behind the scenes talking bad about Benjamin Netanyahu, and we just seem to have no opinion as an administration or a country on the imminent threat from Iran. So it seems like, and I could be wrong, because like you said, it would be in our best interest to help out Israel in this time of peril, but it seems like right now, if we keep going down this direction, we might be pretty irrelevant when it comes down to it.
Well, we are definitely on a slippery slope. This country was called, you know, it's God that establishes the nations, we're told in Acts 17:26. He sets their time and their boundaries. And America, obviously two primary purposes in which we were established. One was to be a beacon of Christianity to the world, and we have. We've sent missionaries out forth. And two was to be a safe haven for Israel, and we have. And we've got, you know, the Jews started coming over here and out of oppression, and there's 5 million or so Jews here, and there's a couple million of them in New York. And we were called to be an instrumental player in the restoration of the nation Israel. President Truman in 1947 was one of the strongest leaders proposing favorably for the rebirth of the nation Israel. And we have been Israel's ally. They struggled through those wars. So We are going through as moral problems internally. We have a president now who says we are no longer just a Christian nation. That was in June of 2008, but a nation of non-believers and Buddhists and Muslims and things like that. You know, we get the kings we deserve. We've been seeing remedial judgments, Hurricane Katrina, September 11th, the Middle East wars, the financial collapse, the mortgage implosions, the BP oil spill, the worst record tornadoes in 2011. I mean, this is a wake-up time. And so the one thing that was boding well for us, you know, I mean, there's a reason Billy Graham came out and said, if God doesn't judge San Francisco, he owes God, Sodom and Gomorrah an apology. Our country has said goodbye to God. He's taken out of our textbooks. He's taken out of our schools. and we're the capital of pornography in the world. But maybe our saving grace for a while had been that we still blessed Israel. But now that is changing. And, you know, and we have, speaking of Iran, General Martin Dempsey, who's one of the lead generals, spokesperson for the Obama administration, came out today and said that they still believe Iran is a rational actor, that they can still be negotiated with. You know, this is what Obama's policy was from day one when he came into the office, was a policy of engagement. This is why he went to Cairo and spoke in June of 2009 and tried to reach out to 1.3 million billion Muslims. And, of course, that has backfired. We can't even get our hostages out of Egypt right now. Sam LaHood's, the head of the Department of Transportation's son is over there with several Americans, and we're struggling to negotiate their release to get back into our country. You know, this another interesting thing, I don't want to rabbit trail away from this, is that a Gallup poll was taken on February 6th, and because we're threatening that we're threatening to not give aid. We give them like $1.3 billion to Egypt. We're threatening to take away the U.S. aid. And a Gallup poll was taken on February 6th, and 71% of the Egyptians don't want any more U.S. aid. So everything is turning. This policy and engagement is backfiring. And our president has followed the same failed footsteps of George H. Bush at the Madrid Conference in 1991, of Bill Clinton at the Camp David Summit in 2000, of George W. Bush with his roadmap plan, two-state solution, in April of 2003, and Obama has come out and embraced the Saudi Peace Initiative, drafted in 2000 by King Abdullah, which calls for Israel to give back the land it acquired in 2007. We are continuing to ask to request that Israel would divide the land. It's the very thing we're told in Joel 3:2 that the Lord judges the nations for in the Armageddon campaign. Apart from the fact that the Arabs want to dispossess Israel of the land, and that's their final mandate in Psalm 83, the one country in all the world that has tried the hardest over the last 2 to 3 decades, going back to the time of Jimmy Carter in 1979, who made this deal with Sadat, Israel gave back the Sinai, it's a multiple amount of land. Land for peace goes way back almost 3 or 4 decades. We are the country that is forcing Israel to divide God's land. This does not bode well for this country. That's why you have guys like Jonathan Cahn coming out writing books like The Harbinger, the 9 Harbinger signals that we should be looking at, that this country is under severe remedial judgments and warnings, that we need to turn around, we need to repent, we need to have a Nineveh moment. And if we don't see that, and if we turn our back on Israel, we pretty much put the final nail in the American coffin. And that's how I see it, and I know that's not good news, but the good news is Jesus Christ is our Savior, and he's coming really, really soon. If all these prophecies we're talking about are about to happen soon and sequentially, each building upon another, and the Lord saw them coming and told us about them and warned us about them, it means he's in control, and it means his son is returning to get us and take us up in the twinkling of an eye into the clouds to be with him forever. And some of the listeners may be having time struggling to even make their rent or to make their mortgage payment, or they may have lost their house in this terrible economy. But I would remind them in John 14 that there's a welcome mat on a mansion in heaven built for them if they believe in Jesus Christ. And if they listen closely enough, they can hear the divine carpenter pounding in the finishing nails on that mansion for them. So don't lose hope, dear listener. You know, just you've got to have your faith in Jesus Christ, because today is a day of salvation. Luke 21:36 tells us to watch, therefore, and pray always that you may escape all these things. So, you know, this is what we should be doing, watching and praying. And the only way to escape the things that are forthcoming is to have faith in Jesus Christ and to be taken out. There is no place to hide when these things come down in this world. The best place to be is in those mansions in heaven.
I was thinking that Bill was reading my mind, because I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about the thing that he brought up. I know in Revelation Road in particular, but in all your teaching, you know, there's a lot of fascinating historical information. The geopolitics is really interesting for all of us to discuss. I mean, this whole community is really into this, but But the real issue is what you just mentioned, and that's the evangelism opportunities. And so why don't you continue on talking to us about what you see as evangelism opportunities this year. Still, there's a real heightened sense among everybody, not just believers, but people across the board, across the world, that something is really going on. Bill, talk for a minute about what kind of evangelism opportunities that Bible prophecy teachers and students have.
Well, that's a very important point. We're told in Revelation 19:10 that the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. Jesus' own testimony is prophetic. He fulfilled over 300 prophecies at his first coming, and he is going to fulfill several hundred more, I believe, at his second. I don't know the exact number. But before it says the testimony of Jesus Christ is the spirit of prophecy, it says worship God, for the testimony of Jesus Christ is the spirit of prophecy. In other words, our natural inclination toward a loving God who tells us the end from the beginning, who loves us so much he cares for us and wants us to know what's coming our way so that we could equip ourselves and steward our lives for the days forthcoming, our natural response should be to worship him. This is an tool of evangelism. Many people come to the Lord or the various different ways that they do. But I came to the Lord through Bible prophecy while attending a Chuck Missler Bible study on the book of Revelation. Many other people have come to the Lord because they have embraced Bible prophecy for what it really is. About a third of the Bible is devoted toward Bible prophecy. And that means about 10,000 passages, and many, many of those passages are dealing with prophecies that we're seeing stage set in our world today. What people have questions, and I believe the Lord has given us a silver platter with prophetic morsels on it to take out into the masses. There's a harvest field that's developing, and it will certainly develop as these prophecies start to unleash. You take 911 as an example. When the towers came down, the world had questions ranging from, was that Armageddon? Did the Bible have anything to say about that? And, you know, many pastors left their congregations and went over there to help out with the crisis at Ground Zero and to witness to people and to pray for people. And there was a harvest field there. And many, many people came to the Lord because of those efforts, because of that harvest field. And that's what we're going to see happening here. We know that from Revelation 6, verses 9, and Revelation 7, the latter parts of Revelation 7, that there's going to be an end times harvest field. And those passages specifically talk about, my estimation, after the rapture happens and the judgments start to happen on the world. But we know that that creates a harvest field, a hunger to know what's going on in their world. These are the days when the pulpits need to share an evangelical and an eschatological message. People need to hear something much more deeper than a seeker-friendly social gospel. Because when they get in their cars and they leave that warm and fuzzy church service and they head home and turn on the news, and pretty soon they're going to see missiles are flying in the Middle East, that warm and fuzzy message is going to run out of gas by, you know, an hour later. They've got to get up and deal with the hard, cold realities and the gas prices shooting up and the types of things that can happen. We could be talking about events that predicate martial law in this country and elsewhere. The Department of Homeland Security has again restated its concerns that this country could be hit by an electromagnetic pulse weapon. And the concerns about that is that it could set this country's electronics and normal societal functions back decades, if not centuries. And, you know, this could be one of the reasons this country may not be in Bible prophecy. So, you know, I encourage people to know these prophecies because, you know, when these events are going on in Egypt, we can start pointing towards Psalm 83 and we can start pointing towards Isaiah 19. When these things are happening in Syria, we can start pointing towards Isaiah 17. Iran is totally in the news. They are mentioned heavily in Ezekiel 38 and Jeremiah 49, as I was talking about earlier. That is going to catch attention. When you go to people and say, you know that stuff you're watching, you know, former UN Ambassador John Bolton is saying this about Iran and that, can I draw your attention to Ezekiel 38? Did you know that Persia
became Iran in 1935, and that 2,500 years ago this prophet wrote about them in an invasion teamed up with Russia and Libya and Turkey. And you know what's happening in Libya, dear person. And you know what, Russia is supplying Iran with fuel rods. They've never been closer as nations in ever. And, you know, I mean, if that doesn't get somebody's attention, they're just not paying attention. And so I think we need to take this information and study it. Share it with people, because the Lord will use that to draw people to him.
Well, amen. That is the exact truth. And you can even go further than that and say, look at the 2010. Many people called that the year of the earthquake because of the record amount of earthquakes that were happening. And you had people come out like Harold Camping predicting the rapture, and then the rapture became kind of mainstream for at least a while there, so people were not just listening to Harold Camping, they were trying to find the truth. And in finding the truth, they go to sites like Prophecy Depot and RaptureReady.com to where they can see, you know, what the Bible actually has to say about it. So prophetic events that are happening all around us do get people wondering, because they do know. And like you said, when they go to church and hear the peaceful gospel message and the love of Jesus Christ that brings, and then they see the world that's happening, when they put two and two together, they can see it all comes from the Bible.
Well, I write in the very opening of Revelation Road the importance of Bible prophecy, and I think it would be timely just to read it briefly, you know, to the listeners. And it says, prophecy is invaluable predictive information given to us by a loving God with a 100% accuracy. In addition to equipping us for the days in which we live, prophecy authenticates God's sovereignty, spares human lives, ultimately saves lost souls. The primary goal of prophecy is to inform us rather than impress us, because God is not someone with too much time on his hands. He is the one who holds all time in his hands. This enables him to share and declare the end from the beginning. And his plan is to pronounce hope rather than announce harm. However, he will not denounce truth when he foreknows it's about to overtake the world. How God knows what he knows, only he knows. But we can be thankful that he does, and that he is willing to share his knowledge with us. Because God so loves us that he wants us to know what's headed our way. And in turn, our natural response should be to worship him for caring. This Bible prophecy is a gift from God. We need to greatly appreciate that. And the goal is ultimately so that people can come to know the Lord, that they can be drawn toward the Lord and appreciate him for all of his different attributes, of which prophecy is among them.
In your travels and in your ministry events and things, what are the top one or two questions that you normally get?
Well, one is about the rapture, the timing of it and the pre-trib rapture. The other is, where's America's in Bible prophecy? What is America's future? The other is, what's on my radar with the Middle East? How do I chronologically order those events? Which is what my book series, it's a trilogy, Revelation Road is the first book, attempts to do, is to chronologically order the events between now and the second coming of Jesus Christ when he sets up his kingdom. So those are the main questions, and a lot of people are very, very concerned about America right now. This question came up a little bit earlier, and rightfully so, because this concern is driven by the fact that people find it very hard to find America in the Bible, that America has fallen from its Christian heritage, and that we're living in the last times. So people are and we're going through crises over here. I mean, this mortgage implosion and this economic collapse that we're going through, and unemployment goes up to 9%, we hear even today, this is very problematic for people. These are real problems running real people living in this country that are very concerned it's not going to get better, that it's going to get a whole lot worse before it gets better. And you throw in the type of prophecies we're talking about, they are justified in that thinking.
Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me. God bless you guys.